Tuesday night edition of the Dunk Time Basketball Podcast. We have much to discuss. We talked about the Steph Curry news yesterday, then unfortunately the Chris Paul and Blake Griffin news over the last 24 hours put a real damper on the Clippers season. Also, we have another great game to discuss, the Toronto-Indiana. Also, we'll get to Atlanta and Boston, and also a little bit about yesterday's games as well. I'll probably focus more on Charlotte and Miami for that one. I'm joined, as often, by Danny LaRue. How are you?
I'm doing okay. A little bit deflated after the last, let's say, 36 hours, but that is the way of the playoffs. You know, that isn't something new.
Yeah, I guess so. It always seems like you wonder why there are so many of these playoff injuries. You know, last year, Kevin Love, Kyrie Irving, and you kind of expect it if a guy is just out for the year because of the regular season, but to have these season-ending injuries during the playoffs, certainly, as you said, it is really deflating. And let's start just with the series, the Portland Clippers series, with both Griffin and Paul out, J.J. Redick looking like a little bit of a shell of himself with that heel contusion. Is there any chance now for the Clippers in this series?
I'll use our friend Kevin Pelton's any chance rule and say, yeah, they have a chance, but it's an extremely low one. And part of it is because Chris Paul fills such an integral role for their success. He is their best perimeter defender, and he is what makes their offense go. And if Chris Paul is out, the guy who's the best suited to make their offense go is Blake Griffin, who is also now out. So it's possible, but they don't really have that many other guys on their roster who are adept at creating for other people. And there are a couple of players, like Redick, who is, of course, limited by the heel contusion, who aren't particularly great at creating for themselves. So, you know, I could see them cobbling together a nice game five or maybe a nice game six, but I don't expect them to win the series.
I would give Portland 75 to 80% chance of winning the series. And where does that 20 to 25% chance for Clippers come from? You could say they have the home court, although it's not an unbelievable Clippers home court advantage compared to maybe some others in the league. But you also at least have guys on the team who over the course of an NBA season would be way too inefficient for you to have a decent offense, but they at least have guys who can create shots. And Jamal Crawford, you know, we saw what he did against Utah in that game where he just went crazy. Austin Rivers, for all of his flaws, is a guy who can create a shot and a guy who can go a little nuts, not as often as Crawford, but, you know, you could see it happening maybe where he just, you know, creates a million of those little floaters and they go in at 60% instead of, you know, the 40% or 35% that they should go in, you know, or Jeff Green actually hits some threes. You know, that's got to be kind of the way it's got to happen for them. I also think their defense is going to be in big trouble now, where Blake wasn't fantastic by any means, but I think he actually was still more intelligent and aware than their other options at the four, other than Mbah Mute, who's going to really choke off their offense now. He's going to be part of their new starting lineup. And then Chris Paul was doing a wonderful job on Damian Lillard, helped by the traps, but also Lillard really trying to get by him was not really very successful. Paul would just kind of cut him off, and Paul is also a master off the ball. So losing him, I think, is going to be a big problem. We also even saw DeAndre Jordan like didn't look like quite himself after he kind of came down a little bit oddly, going for a rebound along the baseline last night. So that might be something to take a slight look at as well. I haven't heard anything about an official injury report there. So yeah, that's where I come up with. I mean, but the Blazers, you know, they haven't won on the road yet. They haven't come close. It's a young team. I wouldn't say it's fait accompli, but they sure are massive favorites to me at this point.
Yeah, they're massive favorites. And another thing that this does is it erodes one of my theories of the series, which was that the Blazers have good talent, but the Clippers just had guys that could counteract that and just had some really amazing strengths, most notably DeAndre Jordan as kind of being a strength where the Blazers don't really have one. I mean, Plumlee's played very well in the series. I'm not knocking it, but DeAndre's been a monster when he's been healthy and engaged and all that. It's just hard.
You know what? On DeAndre, I'm going to Hacka immediately right out of the gate if I'm Terry Stotts.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe,
well,
you know,
maybe you give
every time as soon as you get into the bonus.
Yeah.
I'm doing
yeah.
It.
I would say as soon as you get into the bonus and you tell your guys, you don't have to be as cautious with fouls as you would be normally. So, you know, you don't have to, because a lot of times teams play it a little bit tight early and you don't need your guys to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to do it on any of my main guys in the starting lineup because you need those guys to be all to be able to defend. But, you know, as soon as you're going with putting in someone like Alan Crabb or Gerald Henderson, like those would be the guys that I'd say you could even put in, you know, especially since you're kind of playing designated offense, you could put in a Brian Roberts to do the fouling as well. He's a guy who at least, you know, can hit an open shot. I mean, you might even just go, you could play Roberts, McCollum, and Lillard all together if you wanted to, because you're only playing offense, not defense. And I mean, I wouldn't do it because I necessarily think it's even the greatest strategy, though. You know, DJ is not even hitting 40% in the series, but more just to get Doc to take him out of the game, because once that happens, the Clippers are really, really screwed, you know, because he's their one really premium player who's left now.
And that's why you have to do the logic, because otherwise, if you're comparing it to their standard offense has now been degraded pretty substantially by Chris Paul not being on the floor. So that part of the calculus shifts against Hakka, but DeAndre basically being their only difference maker left, if you can get him off the floor in that sort of way, you have to try.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. And Rivers has shown that he will take him out already in this series, too. So it's a gambit that's worth it, and you just see what happens. And I would go to it early and try to really get DeAndre out of the game. Let's move on now more to the larger ramifications of this. Number one, you have to imagine the Blazers are going to move on. They are not as formidable of an opponent for the Warriors, sans Steph Curry. I would put the Warriors as slight favorites in that series, very slight, if Curry were to not come back at all, maybe just because of home court and because of the defense and the experience that the Warriors have. I do think this Blazers team could still be a big problem for them. So, is that how you would see that matchup as well?
Yeah, I think slight favorite is about where I'd put it, you know, maybe 55-60% in that range. The Warriors, I think their defensive talent could actually work relatively well against Portland in that sense. The issue, as we talked about with Curry's injury when we had that little short thing at the end of your excellent interview with Carol Lawson, was the idea that the Warriors' defense could be worse by the idea that the opponent is going to be getting the ball out of the basket a whole lot less. And so they have that would be a negative factor in it. But beyond that, they have talent to switch a lot of things. Portland is getting a lot of their offense from a small number of players, and that's something that the Warriors are very good at limiting. And so I think they would have some advantages, and it would be, you know, it'd be a big stage for Portland. They've had that before. They made the second round prior. But this Warriors team, of course, has experience, and particularly Draymond Green, I think that he would be somebody who Portland doesn't really have the machinery to handle, though he obviously is a very different offensive player without Curry.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that if that matchup does come to fruition, and maybe we'll have a better idea of what Curry's timetable is by that point as well. And obviously, if the Clippers were to somehow advance, the Warriors would be, still, even without stuff, pretty big favorites there. But the greater thing now, I mean, I think we're go ahead and assume at this point that the Clippers season is over. If they somehow miraculously pull out this series, they're not getting past the Warriors in the next round. So now we're looking at an offseason that Rock Divers has already said he might look at making some changes if they don't get there. They're now not going to. You know, Griffin is out for the remainder of the playoffs. Paul is out indefinitely. He actually had surgery on his hand today. You know, you have to imagine he's gone at least 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah, 6 to 8 is the data, is what I heard.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So what do they do now this offseason? Are they going to move on for one of those big three? Griffin and Paul can both be free agents at the end of 2017. Do you run it back one more time? They're going to have the most they can have if they keep those three guys is about $8 million in cap space, unless you're to move on from other guys who are guaranteed, like JJ Redick would be their only other major salary above $5 million in that situation. So what do you do?
It depends, and this is the same thing that I couched everything in when I wrote the piece about how the Clippers should trade Chris Paul, in what ownership in the front office determine is their definition of success. If you want to be a team that is relevant, you probably run it back unless a team makes you a ridiculous offer. Because the challenge for Blake Griffin is he is at his absolute lowest value that he has ever been in his professional career. Now, his lowest value so far could still be higher than it ends up being in the future. It could also be worth it in that sense. But that is hard to do, especially when you're dealing with a coach GM who has the relationship that he does. And if the, you know, again, it ties back to their definition of success, you know, like, so if Chris Paul is a very special asset, he's an incredibly good player, indisputably valuable player. He does have this weird injury history in the playoffs. So, you know, if Cleveland, whatever happens in their season, if they make the decision that they want to go after him and he's willing to go there, then yeah, of course you listen. But you're so dependent on the offers because it's going to be really hard for them to get better than they are now. And so if that matters, it's very challenging to move any of the three.
My assumption, until I see it proven otherwise, is that Blake Griffin is done as a top 10 player in the NBA. I think he's just the constant injuries are starting to take their toll. I think he's going to be 27 now, a guy who is very dependent on his athleticism before this. You know, his jumper, a work in progress, not something that I ever see being a primary weapon for a guy who's a really, really good player in the league. He'll always kind of be a little bit quicker. He'll have his ball handling ability, but if he can't actually have the explosion to take guys off the dribble, if he's not the same threat in the pick and roll that he was, he's going to be probably a defensive liability to some degree. I just don't see how he's going to get back to that amazing level that we saw him at in last year's playoffs. And that's going to be my default assumption. I'm not saying that he can't possibly get back to that level, but I think it is more likely than not that he's done as like a true superstar player in the league. Now, I agree with you. His value has never been lower, but his value is just going to continue going down considering that he's going to be a free agent. And even if you keep him, you're keeping him presumably at what's going to be a max contract starting at $30 million a year in the summer of 2017. So that's, you know, the value of him even keeping him on your team at that contract, you know, that's probably even going to end up being a negative contract, but that's what you're going to have to pay to keep him just because that's what the dynamics are. So I think you definitely listen to offers and see what's out there. You know, if a team like Boston is really willing to make an offer that like includes one of those Brooklyn picks or something, yeah, I will do that. You know, depending on how good Brooklyn looks like after the summer as well, or, you know, something that really could help you along in rebuilding. The problem there though is that with Chris Paul, you're still want to be competitive, and what trade is out there for Blake that will keep you competitive? Another option too is that they could just move him into somebody's cap space, get back, you know, relatively smaller assets, but then you got enough space to be in the Kevin Durant sweepstakes. And the last component kind of the long range planning here is you might say, well, why don't we just see what if we could just re-sign Chris and re-sign Blake in the summer of 2017 with DeAndre? Will we have any space? Redick will be a free agent then. With the cap holds for those two guys and DeAndre on the books, you're at about $90 million committed, and the cap is supposed to be $107. So you're probably not going to have enough to really bring in another game-changing guy, despite what will be a very good free agent class that summer. So I think I listen. If there's nothing out there that I feel like is really going to change it, all right, you run it back. You know, hey, we're still got a team that looks like it's a second-round playoff team. Maybe we could get lucky. They almost got really lucky this year. You know, you never know what can happen. But I think I'm definitely listening, and if there's an offer there that you feel like is decent, you know, something in the range of, like, you know, picks that could be in the top 10 or, you know, really good young players that could also help right now, I don't know. We'll talk more about what that offer might be, but I'm definitely listening really hard if I'm Rock Divers.
It's a major challenge also with Blake, because when guys get older, and we've talked about this with LeBron for a long time, is one of the easy things you can do to counteract father time is sliding a guy down a position. So, you know, so a guy moving from the two to the three or so on and so forth, whether it be defensive role, offensive role, or both. Blake Griffin defensively cannot be your center. If he's your center, then you're giving up a whole bunch of other things. And this is ignoring the whole DeAndre Jordan part of it. But what that does is it changes what his value is when he's 30, when he's 32. And sure, the Clippers have to be thinking about that now, because a year from now, that's the discussion that's going to be happening, is you're going to do that. And I agree with you that whatever contract he's on, he's going to be providing more value in the first 2 to 3 years of it than he will be in year four, and if he re-signs wherever he is, year five. And so I'm not sure that he's going to be at the level where he'll be a clear cut, you know, enough of a slam dunk in those first couple of years to make it worth it. As good of a player as he is, and as marketable as he is, and, you know, he's been a very important piece of that franchise. But the center part of it is really important, because once a player hits a certain level, and the other big part of it, this is incredibly important, is that he is a nice ball handler. He can help be a part of a successful offense. But I think even now, he can't be the linchpin of an awesome offense. So he's
I think last year he could have been.
Maybe.
If you had enough around him. But yeah, I agree with you. Now, he's just been injured so much too. I mean, you don't even know if he's going to be out there. And if he is out there, what effect is that going to have on him? Especially, you know, I'm not a huge believer in this Clippers training staff either. You know, it seems like there is this quad tendon thing probably could have been handled differently. You know, it shouldn't have been an injury that took 4 months to heal, or maybe, you know, some sort of a surgery should have been done beforehand. You know, it seemed like they tried conservative treatment and it just you know, wasn't working anyway, even before the broken hand. So I don't know. I agree with you that I think it's just whatever his next contract is going to be pretty ugly, and you're paying for the player that he has been and just his game. I mean, he already has had a significant loss of athleticism, and I only expect that to accelerate as it does for everybody as you get into your late 20s.
And on the medical note, Fred Katz, friend of ours, brought up the point. He had some quotes from Blake that were pretty critical of the medical staff from earlier in the season, and I thought that was interesting, just considering he is maintaining a relationship with that team beyond the season. At least that would have been his expectation at that time.
Yeah, you know what? I probably would rather have Chris Paul, despite the fact that he is 4 years older than Blake. I would rather have Chris Paul on his next contract, I think, than Blake on his. I think Chris Paul might even age better than Blake, and he doesn't bring along the fit issues of being a power forward who needs the ball and can't shoot. And if he's not, you know, a great threat himself with the ball in his hands, then, you know, he's going to start kind of taking away from others. I think Chris Paul is going to keep working on his game. He's going to become an even more awesome shooter. He's always going to know how to play. And so I think, you know, despite being older, I might almost rather have Chris Paul at whatever exorbitant contract he's going to get in the summer of 2017 than Blake.
I wholeheartedly agree.
So before we move on to that great game between the Raptors and Pacers, I want to tell you about our friends at Indochino. I am a somewhat oddly shaped guy, and I've always wanted a made-to-measure suit. I could never afford one, though. They're thousands of dollars. No longer the case now with Indochino. My listeners can get any premium suit there for just $3.99, up to 50% off at Indochino.com when entering that familiar cap space code at checkout. Shipping is free. You just do 14 measurements that they show you how to do on your website, send those into them. You can pick out the type of suit you want, customize it with the liner, put a monogram on it. I went for a pretty nice shark skin suit with a really cool light blue liner. Got some great compliments on it when I wore it to one of the games earlier in the Warriors Rocket series. Fits me great. Best fitting suit I have ever owned, for sure. And you can get one that fits just as well. Indochino.com. Enter that cap space code so you know, so they know that you came from us, and they will keep advertising with us. You'll get a great fitting suit. The show stays on the air. We all win at Indochino.com. Your look, your way. So Toronto and Indiana, what are your initial thoughts on this one in which the Pacers blew a 15-point lead, I think, at the start of the fourth quarter?
We both believed that there were adjustments that each team needed to make in this series. Dwayne Casey made just about every one that we hoped. They just about all worked. Frank Vogel did not, and that adjustment may have cost them this game, or lack of adjustment.
Yeah, and what you're talking about is the fact that he has insisted on playing lineups to start the second and fourth quarter without Monte Ellis, Paul George, or George Hill, their three best perimeter players, on the floor at the same time. And Ty Lawson, who came over from the Rockets, may have been the one who was supposed to help with that. Ty Lawson is not the same guy anymore, despite an okay game four. And Zach Lowe, I mean, it was an issue at the start of the series. It was an issue in the regular season. Zach Lowe even wrote about it, how he thought when the games mattered, they would go away from that. They have not. And you had some stats on how badly they've gotten outscored with those lineups on the floor in this series.
Yeah, so during this series, the Pacers have been outscored by 28.8 points per 100 possessions with Paul George out, which has been 51 minutes, and that translates to 29 actual points, just because of, you know, how it works out. And in this game, which is incredibly important, they only played 6 minutes and 9 seconds without, you know, in those early second, early fourth stretch. They scored a total of 1 point during that 6 minutes and 9 seconds.
That's bad.
Yeah, especially when you give up 17.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? So you say, what's the adjustment? Now, you have to also note that because of the fact that he's playing all of his starters with George more often, that they're killing in those minutes generally, right? So you are going to be sacrificing potentially a little bit there. And, I mean, for me, the option would be go with George Hill in those minutes. I think they have not played George Hill enough. He still only played 34 minutes in this one. And they went with Monte at backup point guard a little bit too. But I think George Hill has just got to play 40 minutes in this series. I mean, he's 30, going to be 31, I think, at the end of next year. But I think you just got to have him out there and just let him kind of run the offense a little bit more. You know, he doesn't do that as much now that he plays with Monte and with Paul George being back this year, unlike last year. So that would be my option. And then also, that would help a lot because Kyle Lowry is usually on the floor during those minutes as well. And now you have someone to guard Kyle Lowry instead of having to go with Lawson. And so at least maybe you have a chance of stopping them. I mean, you noted that it was the score was like 110-83. So they're not stopping them and they're not scoring. At least with Hill out there, you could probably score a little bit better. But more importantly, at least you can kind of get closer to a scoreless tie because that unit's got Lawson, CJ Miles, Rodney Stuckey, not really guys who are great defenders. And so you're getting lit up at the same time that you're not scoring as well.
Yeah, that's one path and completely justifiable. The other one, which I support either, but I would lean towards this way, is to shift Monte a little bit. And the reason for that isn't so much that I think Monte would be a better fit for that. It's that you have a more effective replacement for him with the starters. So if you play CJ Miles as the middle guy between George Hill and Paul George, I think he'll do pretty well. You know, he's not going to do everything Monte does, but he will provide he provides gravity. He can hit open shots. I think you actually give him a better opportunity to succeed. And Monte can help just kind of keep that unit above water. There are major defensive flaws with it. So you can try both. You can consider it. But part of the reason I lean that way is just because I think that you do less to hurt your starters. I mean, that was a point that Mike Prada brought up today, is the idea that you are, by shifting any one of these three to those lineups, you are making the starters worse. But I think that switching Monte and CJ makes the starters worse by a smaller degree.
Yeah, and we are guilty of focusing a little bit too much on these coaching things, but on the other hand, you don't need me to tell you that Paul George played great and, you know, DeMar DeRozan had 34 points. You know, that's not like presumably the type of analysis you come to this show for. And you mentioned the adjustments from Casey. He finally started Patrick Patterson in what was both long overdue and satisfactory, but also annoying because it's like he knew what he should have been doing this whole time. And then Scola doesn't even play at all, right? Like, if the guy is really a good enough player to be starting for you, he shouldn't be just completely out of the rotation, you know, once you decide to switch him up. But that was the right decision. And I thought early on, at least, they were getting good shots with Patterson in there, and Patterson had some nice moments defensively in ways that Scola wouldn't have. But the Pacers were on fire, and then especially down the end of the first quarter, they decided to put Terrence Ross on Paul George. That didn't go very well. Actually, that might have been in the second quarter that they did that instead of Powell for whatever reason. They really, Jonas Valanciunas struggled defensively pretty much the entire time that he was out there. So it was not very good to start for Toronto, but then they were able to get back into it a little bit. One, because DeRozan did a better job with George. Two, because George just didn't do as good of a job in this game. He was not as locked in, perhaps because of the fact that he was scoring so well and was tired or just, you know, didn't feel like he needed to defend his heart or whatever. And then also Casey did well to take DeRozan out and then bring him back to start the second when he knew George would be out. And DeRozan was able to do well in that time. That was something else that we had advocated for.
And Norman Powell, I think, did a really nice job in this game. He has established himself as a reliable perimeter defender. He had some nice plays in transition as well. And it's something David Locke has talked about it for a long time, and I think we both agree with him, is that series get smaller, and part of the reason series get smaller is because those guys are generally more skilled, and Norman Powell has proved that he deserves to play in this series.
Yeah, the Pacers started, again, Turner and Mahimi together, but generally they were going with one big, and Solomon Hill ended up playing 30 minutes as the backup four, you know, just the type of guy you would expect to have his rookie option declined, of course. And yeah, we're just never going to let that one go. Powell, I mean, was playing at the four a lot of the time. He's strong and he's long and he's really athletic and he plays incredibly hard. And he's also able to space the floor pretty well from that spot, although he didn't shoot incredibly well in this one. He's 0-4 on threes. And he got two steals, and just good things happened when he was out there in general. He really locked down Paul George in the fourth quarter, and you know, he was the only one who had much of a chance to stop him. Damari Carroll had done well in Indiana, but then, you know, could not get it going defensively in this one as George was on fire. So, yeah, it was just that was a good decision. They finally started playing him over Ross in the second half. So I think Casey was able to push enough buttons that they were able to get back in the game, and that really helped. But, you know, I think ultimately we have to talk a little bit more just about what the individual players were able to do in this game. It wasn't so much of a strategic game to me as it was just related to that.
And something that bridges that gap is Bismack Biyombo was awesome in this game. I thought he did a really nice job, and they kept him in when he was playing well.
Biyombo had 16 rebounds, 12 on the defensive glass, 4 offensive, 10 points, even hit 4 of 4 from the line. He hit one crazy beat the shot clock 20 footer as well with a hand in his face in the first half when they were just fiending for a bucket. And he was just played so hard defensively. He was all over the place as well. Paul George was really hurting them on pick and rolls, getting to jumpers in the first half with Valanciunas just laying back. And Biombo, especially in the fourth quarter, was able to get up to the level of the ball, take that away, and then still retreat back to Miles Turner, who was often the roll man. Indiana could get very little going inside against him, especially in the fourth quarter. And Casey, to his credit, made the right move in keeping Biombo in rather than going back to Valanciunas. He also could have very easily gone back to Damari Carroll. I normally like going back to the starters, but I think in this case, those guys are playing really well defensively, and they're close enough in skill set that when they were playing well and the other guys had played poorly, you are justified in closing with the reserves, and that worked. It was just an awesome defensive unit along with Corey Joseph in that fourth quarter.
Something small that I was interested in and kind of thought about offhand and actually went back and checked is that in Toronto's two losses, Biombo had a combined 5 turnovers, and in their 3 wins, he has a combined 2. So it's a small thing, you know, that's not that many possessions, but it does seem like he's more confident in certain situations, and then that's really, and as much as he's a defensive player in some ways more than an offensive player, I think they can feed together with him.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, he at least provides you with a little bit of a roll threat coming down the lane. He could get up maybe for some alley-oops. He set good screens. He had a couple of nice plays where he flipped the screen, was able to help guys get into the lane down the end, which we'll talk about. We're going to go through all the possessions at the end. So he was really good. A couple other notes. Kara and I talked about how you free DeRozan against Paul George, and I had asked her on the podcast yesterday, you know, do you keep going to him or do you start going away from him? And she thought, no, he's one of your all-stars. You got to just keep going to him. That strategy paid off. But they also did a couple other things, too. They had pick and rolls with small guys in transition with Lowry screening for him. They got a couple of nice looks for DeRozan that way. They also were running some of those elbow splits. I really recommend you go back and listen to that podcast, by the way. She was one of the best guests we've ever had.
It was excellent.
And so she recommended that. They were able to get some of that action where instead of just doing a straight dribble handoff, they were kind of running elbow splits and getting another screen for DeMar before he would go in and get the ball from the big at the elbow. And he was able to get downhill on those plays and also get to the free throw line as well. And he also took, you know, some catch and shoot threes. I think the fact that he hasn't been able to get going on his long twos has led him to space out a little bit more. And he hit a couple of key catch and shoot threes, which he kind of is able to hit, but just doesn't really take that much for some reason.
Yeah, it's not like he's so much worse at those than the deep twos he takes. For whatever reason, he's a lot more comfortable with that.
Yeah, so in the end of the game, the Raptors had tied it at 92. Paul George just kind of left Terrence Ross in the corner for a three. That was one of the plays I was talking about where I felt like he wasn't that good. DeRozan still wasn't in at that point. And then Norman Paolo got a steal on George and went down for a dunk that I thought he actually took off from too far and was going to brick it because he took off from so far. And he almost did, but he threw it down. It was an awesome dunk. And after Terrence Ross missed a bunch of shots, they put DeRozan back in with 5 minutes left. We'll pick it up there. And it started off with Miles Turner getting a shot clock violation after there had been a foul. And just the only reason I bring this up, I made this point before, but I feel like teams get a lot of shot clock violations after fouls when the shot clock goes to 14. And I think you should at least make it 16 to and maybe even 18 to more approximate the amount of time you normally have in a half court set, because I think it puts the offense at a little bit of a disadvantage. And that's not what the intent is supposed to be after a foul to me.
Yeah, and then I completely agree with you. Next possession down, the Pacers are on defense. There was a miscommunication, which, as you said, and I think you were right, it might have been just because it was so loud that they couldn't actually hear each other talk.
Yeah, Monte Ellis and Miles Turner messed up a bunch of pick-and-roll coverages towards the end, and a couple of times, usually most of the time, like, I mean, they screwed it up every way you could. On this one, it was Monte icing it, and Miles Turner, oh no, I'm sorry, Monte did not ice it, and Miles Turner was there kind of expecting him to be forced baseline, and Lowry got middle. This set up the DeRozan three as he got middle. Paul George came way off DeRozan to get into charge position on Lowry, and Lowry gave it up, and DeRozan was just as open as you're ever going to get in that point of the game for a three. And then the next time down, George couldn't get any separation on Paul after a pick and roll. This is one of those plays where Biombo came way out on Paul George, and George could have moved the ball initially, but he kind of waited, let Biombo get back under the rim, and then he threw it to Solomon Hill, who was able to drive past DeRozan, but Biombo was already there waiting, and then they threw it out to Monte Ellis. Lowry had helped onto Turner when the drive occurred. He closed all the way out to Ellis, and Ellis had to brick a three with like 2 seconds left on the shot clock. It was Lowry, one of the best help defenders from the point guard position. On occasion, he'll overdo it. He did that a little bit in the first half when George Hill was hitting those threes. But on this occasion, especially with a guy like Ellis instead of George Hill, who's a great underrated spot-up shooter, it really worked out.
Then the next play continued the storyline of messed up pick-and-roll coverages. DeRozan was there. They had set a screen. Paul George couldn't get over it. And then that required George Hill to help, and that created, granted, you don't think this is going to be a devastating opportunity, but created a wide-open Corey Joseph three.
Yeah, on this one, this was one of those ones where Biombo flipped the screen because George was already icing it, but it was so far out on the floor that you can set the screen, you know, facing basically the opposite baseline, and when the guy is already in ice coverage, you're now forcing him right into the screen. And that's not the end of the world if it's lower towards the baseline of the basket that you're facing, but when it's so far out on the floor, that lets the guy get ahead of steam up and get to the basket. And Turner still was there on DeRozan. He had it contained, but George Hill came all the way over, was standing in the restricted area off of the weak side corner. And while Joseph, again, not a guy who's going to hit threes, Hill did not need to get quite that far over. I thought Turner had it. But that's, you know, it's a really tough judgment call to make. And I'm sure that they're saying, hey, Corey Joseph is not a shooter. DeMar DeRozan on the previous possession is not a shooter. You know, we're going to help off of these guys. But to Joseph's credit, he made him pay with a corner three. And so then it was a timeout. They're down. The Pacers were down six at this point, and that completed a 22-3 run for Toronto. At that point, I think the Pacers had scored 3 points with about 2.5 minutes left in the fourth quarter.
And then, you know, another one of kind of those plays that just didn't go perfectly. They had a nice hammer play for Paul George, and then it ended up yielding an open three, but it didn't go in.
Yeah, it was hammer plays, for those who don't recall, is a lot of coaches love to run at late game. I think the Spurs were the first to do it, where you'll drive from one side of the floor and then have a big set of back screen for whoever the wing is on the other side going to the corner. And Norman Powell got totally beat by that play. George was wide open. It was actually really good job by DeMar DeRozan, who was guarding Solomon Hill totally on the other side of the floor. He was just standing in the lane. He sniffed out what was going on and actually was able to get out there and semi-contest. It was still a great look for Paul George, but good recognition from DeRozan, as best as you could have hoped, seeing that Powell just got destroyed on the screen by Miles Turner, a totally legal, good screen. But George just wasn't able to make the shot. I mean, it's as good a look as you can hope for. That's a play that Vogel loves running out of timeout, so we actually saw it later on as well. But, you know, make or miss league on that one, everything that you wanted for Indiana.
So then you have another thing that we like that they incorporated more in this game, a 2-1 pick and roll. And it yielded what would have been a Kyle Lowry open look, except DeRozan shot it instead and didn't yield.
Yeah, I mean, what they were doing on this play, and they ran it again later, was Lowry would come up. The Warriors do this a lot with Steph and Klay Thompson. When Thompson is the screener, he'll come up like he's going to set the screen, and usually you would think about switching or at least hedging on that play. So if you slip the screen out to the opposite side, your man is going to kind of slow down a little bit. And Lowry was open, but DeRozan just took a shot over Paul George, a long two that was not a good shot, and it missed. And then PG was able to post up on Norman Powell the next time down, spun baseline, hit a nice lefty reverse layup before the help got there. But you could tell at this point he was just so tired, like he had no explosion on that play. But they had to keep bringing him back in because those bench units were getting slaughtered. Vogel just couldn't go on without him on the bench any longer.
Yeah, and so then we get into a possession, which I think it's an issue for both of us, but I get to intro it and get to do my little tirade on it first. So it took Toronto a little bit to get into their offense, but they ended up doing a high pick and roll. Lowry got the separation he needed, and he got hit and when he was going for the layup, and Bill Kennedy waited, and when the shot didn't go in, by this point Lowry's past the stanchion, then they call the foul. And to me, a foul is a foul whether or not the shot goes in. And it's just crazy that they still do that kind of officiating when the stakes are that high.
Yeah, especially in the fourth quarter as well. And now maybe you can say, hey, you know, better late than never. He realized that because he missed the shot, it's like you kind of go over it again in your mind as an official and say, all right, well, this contact actually was pretty significant. You know, you see where the guy lands and ends up. But nonetheless, that happens like pretty often. I mean, usually, refs, you're taught to, if you see it, call it on instinct immediately. You know, it is what it is. He made two free throws. It was a foul. You know, I mean, I think that we can both agree on that. It's pretty clear that Turner put his forearm into his back. So, you know, no harm in that sense to Indiana. It's not like they, you know, he called a call that wasn't there. But, you know, it was still a little bit fishy. And it also just kind of makes people wonder about it.
Well, do you remember the prominent one of that last year?
No, I don't.
So, apparently, I heard this recently. I did hear it at the time. But on that crazy Stephen Curry made three that tied, I think it was game three against New Orleans, the ref apparently admitted to him that they would have called that foul if he hadn't made the shot.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Marcus Thompson had that.
Yeah.
That one of the Warriors said that the refs told him that after the game, which is pretty crazy. Well, the next time down was another one of these make or miss league plays, right? I mean, and you look at it, two wide open threes, one by DeRozan, one by Corey Joseph, go down in the last 5 minutes. Another wide open three. This was just a 3-1 pick and roll that got George Hill a wide open look. You know, another great shooter. He and George have been money all series from three, and he missed his shot too. So two wide open misses by Indiana from great shooters, two wide open makes for Toronto by, you know, pretty bad spot up shooters, you know, relative to most of the guys at their position.
Yeah, and I wanted to mention also, I tweeted this during the game, George Hill's ability as a catch and shoot guy is really underrated. And I mean, he had this issue of creating offense for a while, but as a catch and shoot guy, he was actually ninth in the NBA in 3-point percentage off catch and shoot opportunities this year.
The next time down, more pick and roll foibles between Monte and Miles Turner. This time, Monte iced him. Turner was not there, and Lowry was able to get right to the cup and then found Powell for a wide-open corner three that missed. But then, because the Pacers were a little discombobulated, Kyle Lowry was able to actually get a hand on the offensive rebound, tip it back out, and they were able to waste another 18 seconds or so up four. Until then, Turner was able to reject Lowry after that same DeRozan-Lowry pick and roll. They called a timeout to set that up, and DeRozan actually threw it to Lowry. He got in the lane, and then Turner just sent his floater back. And then Paul George missed an open pull-up three. Solomon Hill, unbelievable play, runs in from the side, gets his hand on it, falling out of bounds, whips it lefty back to Paul George, gets back in bounds in the corner, and drains a three to bring Indiana within one with 13.9 remaining at that point. Just a great play from Solomon Hill, who did not have his rookie option picked up by the Indiana Pacers last fall.
Yeah, his fourth-year option, which I think was worth like $2.1 million.
It might have even been less than that. Just incredible that wasn't picked up in this cap environment. So they foul immediately afterwards. DeRozan makes both free throws, so Pacers are down three. After a foul to give from Toronto, they ran a sideline out of bounds play, got it to Ellis on the right side, and Ellis tried to drive, and we were making fun of him for just throwing up a terrible shot that was a quick two, and how could you draw up that quick two, and Monte, you know, it's got $11 million a year for three more years of this, and blah, blah. But going back and looking at it more closely, I was way too hard on him, and I regret tweeting that, because it seems clear that they're trying to set up another hammer play, and on this one, Norman Powell learned his lesson from the first time, was all over it, just had George locked up, wouldn't even let him run into the corner, wouldn't even let himself get screened. And then Monte couldn't even get baseline either. I think it was Corey Joseph who was guarding him that just wouldn't even let him get baseline to where he could have had the passing angle. So Ellis was just he had no play other than to just kind of throw it up. And to his credit, he at least fought for the rebound and got the Pacers the ball back after what was a lengthy review.
Yeah, and which also helped them out, because I think they still had a timeout remaining, which it seemed like they were going to have to use. But the problem for me, and this is just a personal preference thing, with running a hammer play when you're down three with that short a period of time, is that there is very little time. There's a lot of time where the ball is inside the three-point arc and very little time where it is outside. So you actually open up the possibility, if a team wanted to tactically foul, which Toronto did not do, and there's only one way that play produces a three-point look. You know, you don't really have options on it that create real opportunities. And so, you know, it's not a terrible thing. It's not as bad as, let's say, what ended up happening at the end of not the current Hawks-Celtics game, but the prior one. But I just don't love hammer plays in that situation, specifically down three.
Yeah, because the other team is really going to be on alert for a three. You know, I think they're better kind of, you know, if you're down two, maybe you go for it, because then at least if you, getting a two is not the end of the world. But yeah, I mean, you can just, it's a high risk, high reward play. Vogel loves them. That's the way to get Paul George the ball. He was pretty tired. He wasn't necessarily going to be able to create his own shot. But yeah, it didn't work out, but they got it back. And then their first baseline out of bounds attempt, Biombo did a great job switching on to George, denying the ball in bounds. So they had to take their last time out. And then that last play was absolutely crazy. They set a screen away from the baseline for George, lobbed it up to him, and he caught the ball. Paul did a great job getting there, but then George was able to rip it through back towards the left side, and it looked like George was going to be open. And Corey Joseph came off of his man, Solomon Hill, deterred George from shooting the shot, and George passed it to Hill, and Hill was just as close to getting a game-winning shot off as you possibly can be. I think, I mean, even like one, you know, 2/100ths of a second more, and that's probably the game winner, but it was still touching his middle finger as he shot it, and the Raptors won. What did you think of Joseph's decision to go and double?
First off, it would have been a game tire, not a game winner. Just
thank you.
Just to note that, and to avoid some tweets coming back. And so at first I thought it was a mistake, but realistically, with how much time was remaining, and I'm not sure exactly if this is what was in Corey Joseph's head, but you are forcing a ludicrously fast release in that situation. I think Hill caught the ball with 5/10ths of a second left.
Yeah, it was actually, it was 0.8 when it first hit his hands, but then he had to take a little bit of a
and
dip.
It was kind of below his waist, I believe, or it was like maybe around
waist. Yeah, I mean,
he
caught it, he took a dip, and then he went up. No, I thought it was a great play by him, and Seth was disagreeing with me, but I thought that, I mean, with 2 seconds left is when he decided to leave, basically. He gets there with 1 second left. George was going to be open. He would have had a very good look. He's their best player. He's been killing it from three-point range the entire series. He was going to have a nice look over Powell after kind of wrong-footing him with that great rip-through move. And that's an emergency situation. Like, I would probably rather, even if I knew that Solomon Hill was going to be able to get the shot off and that George absolutely would pass it to him, I still would have done that and run at George, because you just cannot get beaten by Paul George in that situation. And Solomon Hill, although he shot the three well in this one, was, you know, shot under 30% from three on the year, I recall. So number one, that it was a good play in that sense. And then you throw in, A, George may not even pass it to him. And B, if he does pass it to him, he might run out of time, or it's going to be really close and he's going to have to rush it. So I actually thought it was a great decision. I think that guys, you know, once there's about 2 seconds left on the clock, maybe, you know, a little bit under, running at someone is actually a great idea, and that players should do that more. I've said that before, and I thought it was a great play by Corey Joseph to react the way he did.
I've always been interested in the idea of somebody who's kind of on the far side of the play leaving a little bit even earlier than that, with the idea that that's a really hard pass just with the timing, you know, with like 4 seconds to go. Let's say you're on the far side of the floor, just with the idea of, you know, it's a high risk strategy, but just to get the ball over there and have a guy shoot it from there, much less the closer shot, I think that's impractical as well.
Yeah, I think that those kind of plays, you know, and it used to be in the NBA that you couldn't, there was no middle ground, you know, you had to kind of sprint over, whereas now you can get close enough to where you're still kind of deterring the pass, but then you can take a couple of steps and you can be there. You know, in the old NBA, you used to have to do a hard double. Like, you think of the 97 NBA Finals when in game one, Michael Jordan, they didn't double, and Michael Jordan just hit the shot over Brian Russell. And then in game six, they did double, and Stockton just ran over and Jordan stepped through and was able to find Steve Kerr wide open. You know, it's not that severe of a choice anymore in today's NBA. So I do like that as a general strategy, especially to change up, give guys a look that they're not expecting. And especially when you have guys who have pretty big egos, less so in today's NBA than maybe 10 years ago, but still guys who are just going to want to take the shot at the end and have that in their mind that that's what they're going to do. I thought that George reacted pretty well to get it to Hill. I think he made the right play, and but you didn't know that he was going to be able to make that great play, and you at least took him out of what would have, I think, been a better shot than the one that Hill ultimately took, even accounting for the fact that, you know, he didn't get it off.
One stray thought about this game, it made me even more excited about the prospect of it potentially going seven, because I think there's a very real chance that Indiana could win a game seven on Toronto's home floor. You know, I think that this series has a lot of variability in it, and there were parts of this game where you could say Indiana didn't play any better, but then, of course, there were some correctable mistakes, and so I'm very excited to see where the series goes.
Yeah, this is a tough matchup for Toronto. I'm not willing to say that, oh, they have no chance in the next round, because we talked about it in the preview, I didn't lose respect for Toronto as a team. We picked this series to go seven because it was a hard matchup. They didn't have an obvious choice to guard Paul George. They've kind of found something, I think, with Powell to a certain extent. We didn't know what Carroll's health was going to be. DeRozan going against George, up until this game, he wasn't really... didn't look like it was something that was going to be successful. The Raptors love to get to the rim. The Pacers have great rim protection. So all of that, I think, was reasons to think that this series was going to be a long series, and it's kind of lived up to that. And the Raptors deserve a ton of credit for being able to find a way in this one with just great defense in the fourth quarter with kind of their defensive unit and just enough shooting as well. I mean, they didn't even play great offense in that fourth quarter. Just the defense was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And they only scored 25 points. They outscored them 25-9 in the fourth quarter.
Wow.
And Indiana had 5 turnovers, was 4 out of 15, and 3 of those makes occurred pretty late. So it was really an outstanding Raptors performance. Before we move on to the rest of the games, let's tell you about our old friends at Vistaprint, now offering you 500 business cards for $9.99 using that familiar CapSpace code. Easy to remember because we talk about CapSpace all the time on the program. I am a small business owner. I need to get some business cards, get some other stuff to market the podcast. Vistaprint has been awesome for that. They offer a ton of custom products, whether it's business cards, postcards, flyers, banners, t-shirts, coffee mugs, whatever it is, you can get your logo on there. And they are just like your neighborhood print shop with their level of customer service, but they have more economies of scale than that place does, and they're able to offer you some great competitive pricing. I've been really happy with their customer service, with the business cards that they gave me. I had a logo already, but if you don't, you can help use one of their industry-specific templates to design your business cards. You can also upgrade to thicker stock, add a brilliant finish. Whatever you want to do, Vistaprint offers that level of customization for you. So get started today with Vistaprint for those 500 business cards starting at just $9.99. Use that CapSpace code at checkout. Let them know that you came from us, and you'll get a great support for your small business and support the show as well. Vistaprint.com, CapSpace code. Atlanta-Boston was not a classic.
Thank you for admitting that.
But I would be hard-pressed to recall a game that shifted like this. Atlanta had 19 points in the first 18 minutes of the game. It was 29-19 Boston. And then the Hawks scored 70 points in the next 18 minutes, outscoring Boston 70-33. Boston was 6 of 34 at the 18-minute mark of the game. And then they made their next 10 shots. It was just an incredible change for the Hawks. I'm not really even sure what accounts for it, frankly. They just started moving the ball. Everyone was hitting their threes, and it was an incredible scoring performance from a team that really had struggled to score throughout much of this series.
Can I use the phrase feedback loops? Because I think that was a part of it, not the entire thing. I mean, they were just nailing shots. But I do think that when you have the combination of effective defense and potent offense, it makes it a lot easier to succeed in both. And I think it really did work together for the Hawks in this game.
So let me give you some stats for that period in which they scored, that 18-minute period in which they scored the 70 points. Atlanta was 10 out of 16 on threes, 27 of 38 from the field overall. 20 of their 27 buckets were assisted, and it was pretty much everyone on the team. Mike Scott went crazy. He actually led them during that period with 13 points, but they had 4 guys who were in double figures, and then Paul Millsap also had 9 points during that. Schroeder had 7, and Al Horford had 6. It was just, they're completely unstoppable, and it was just that beautiful egalitarian Hawks offense that we grew to love last year that has been absent for large parts of this year. Kyle Korver was finally able to get going, and he really has been the biggest part of this Atlanta offense. In games 2 and this game, when he played well, then you have to respect him a lot more. He's able to get open, and he's one of the most efficient guys in the league when he is rolling. And then defensively, they also had 9 steals, 4 of which belonged to Korver during that period as well. So he was fantastic, and his drop off from last year, just due to age and the fact that he had to rehab that ankle injury all last summer, he hasn't been as good, but at least in this one, he was fantastic. And then for the Celtics, Evan Turner had 11 points, but also was negative 37 in those 18 minutes. Really just a pretty rough period. The only other thing that I will note is that Amir Johnson only played 6 of those minutes and was only -8, which for that period was actually fantastic. Jared Sullinger played a lot of it too. He was -15. Kelly Olynyk was -12. And I really wondered, especially in the third quarter, they were still within 7 when Sullinger checked in for Amir Johnson, I guess because Amir Johnson had a turnover, but you know, it was pretty early on and Johnson has been good in the series. And then as soon as Sullinger came in, they proceeded to get completely murdered.
Yeah, it was a pretty unbelievable stretch just overall for the Hawks, and similarly unbelievable is the fact that we've gone this far talking about this game without discussing the Isaiah Thomas spraining his ankle because he was inexplicably still in this game.
They were down 27, either 27 or 29.
I think it was 29.
At the start of the fourth quarter.
Oh, at the start of the quarter. I think it was 27.
Yeah, so, and Brad Stevens was asked to address why Thomas is in the game. I tweeted asking what the reason was, you know, especially when they play again in 2 days and he's probably going to need to play 45 minutes in that game because they just can't do anything offensively when he's not on the floor. And he got locked up, by the way, in this game. Jeff Teague, actually, who had been much criticized for his defense in the 2 Boston games on Thomas, did a great job on him. And Thomas also looked like he was a lot of gas. But in any event, yeah, he kind of tweaked his ankle. He said that he had hurt it already in game 4. He thought he would be ready. But Brad Stevens was asked why Thomas was still in the game, and here's what he had to say.
You know what, with this team, you know, I think it's a very valid question. With this team, I've seen just enough crazy stuff to think that we might be able to get back in and give him a chance from 12 to 9 or 8 to see if it can happen. He was actually had a sub at the table when it happened. So, you know, I know that's quite a task and quite a mountain to overcome, but we've all seen this team do some pretty crazy things when they're down.
So basically, it seems like because they came back from 24 down at halftime in that regular season game against Miami, that's why Brad wanted to give it a shot. But number one, this wasn't halftime. This was a playoff game, and they had just been doing so poorly, and you have another game coming up either. It wasn't the last game of the regular season where you know you're going to have time off. So I would not have had him in there. I tweeted to that effect. This is not hindsight. I said that actually before he got injured. Hopefully it won't be something that affects him, but it was not the best day between that and not playing Amir. I mean, they still would have lost. This Hawks team was unbelievable in this game. But between leaving Thomas in, not playing Amir that much, it was not Brad Stevens' best day, even though, you know, he had this hagiography about him by Jackie McMullen, which is actually really good. I mean, don't mean to denigrate it by saying that, and you should read it. But it was ironic that, you know, him, an article proclaiming him the next great coach came out on the day that he didn't have one of his best days.
Yeah, I think that the way to think about this, and I focused a lot on injury-based stuff for my entire writing career, is the idea of what can be gained versus what can be lost. And so you have 2 major factors. One is that, you know, there isn't much that's going to happen. You know, it's very unlikely that you're going to win the game, but you can get issues related to cumulative strain, you know, just playing him more minutes, and the sheer random chance that is just the possibility of injury at any second. You know, you can step on a guy's foot, you can do any number of things. And as a coach, you have an obligation to know when a game is won and to know when a game is lost, and also know that those decisions don't have to be final if something weird happens. And so, yeah, there was this outside chance that they could have a big comeback, but you have to take care of your players because you know that they want to be out there. And if he already had a pre-existing injury, then that's an even stronger reason to make sure that he's not out there.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. And you know, I think what you do there is you put in a bunch of young guys who are going to just go crazy and like try and pressure or do something. And then if it starts to get manageable again, you get within 15. OK, come back with the starters. But yeah, I didn't think that was the greatest idea by any means. Dan Feldman had a couple tweets kind of reminding us where we are just in an overall statistical sense in these series. He noted that when the home team wins the first 5 games of best of 7, which has happened here, the road team is 32-24 in game 6s, but then only 5 of those 24 home game 6 winners actually won the series. So that's got a long way to go. And Stevens, you know, I mean, I think I don't know that any team, maybe the only time I can think of that a team has come back from that big of a deficit was like the Clippers against Memphis in the fourth quarter I want to say 2012. And that's the only time I can think of in either regular season or postseason that a team has overcome a 27-point deficit in one quarter to win. Maybe the only other one that comes to mind is maybe I think like the Lakers beating Dallas, at one point in the 2000s. It's the only other one I can think of. But because I'm not a computer, I will stop spewing these out to you now.
Yeah, I mean, the Rockets in that crazy Game 6 win over the Clippers, they were down, I think it was 18 and late in the third quarter, and ended up having a 40-15 quarter in that fourth quarter, but that wasn't the margin. So, you know, they could have theoretically come back on that kind of a thing. I think they had like a 22-2 run at some point in there. But again, they didn't have to come back from 27 down.
Let's get to Charlotte and Miami from yesterday. I thought this was a fascinating game. I've really been enjoying everything about this series and the tactical matchups. Again, this was much more of the pattern that I foresaw this series taking on, not even necessarily Charlotte winning, but just that it was going to be a slog defensively. I think that actually, while Charlotte misses Nick Batum, they have gotten a lot better defensively without him. He's never a guy, despite the fact that he looks like he has pretty good tools, who you can find any statistical evidence that he's a great defender. And since they've downsized putting Marvin Williams at the three, they've really been able to pack the paint more with two bigs who, although they're not incredibly athletic, at least are guys who have well-honed help instincts and are more likely to kind of leave Miami shooters who, you know, which is sort of what you want to be doing anyway. And I think that's worked for Charlotte, and they really outplayed Miami in this one with the exception of a 17-1 Miami run that got them back into it. But I thought that, you know, Charlotte was the better team pretty significantly in both of the games in Charlotte. I'm absolutely fascinated to see what's going to happen in this series going back to Miami tomorrow.
I am too. One thing that struck me in this game was that Miami was just under 40% from the field, and they were almost at 38% from three. And that's, you don't usually see a team with that's that close. And I think to a certain degree, I mean, obviously you don't want to have a team that's shooting 38% from three, but on the aggregate, I think that's something close to what Charlotte would take.
Well, it's amazing. The Heat were 11 out of 29 on threes, and Charlotte was 4 out of 16. I think they're averaging 4 made threes in the series, a team that was up among the league leaders in three-point attempts, and then that they're forcing Miami to take them. It's both teams have done a great job now, especially as we move on to these games in Charlotte, of taking away the other team's strength. And the Heat are great at getting to the foul line, but the Hornets actually were 25 out of 30. They've been getting a ton of calls. Jeremy Lin, I think, has drawn more fouls than all but three or four players, these are like superstar guys who are playing 40 minutes a game. In the playoffs, the Heat were not happy with the number of calls that he's been getting, but I don't recall any that were particularly egregious. I thought the other thing that was key was keeping the Heat out of the paint. 12 out of 23 at the rim, 23, not as many as they're getting. Whiteside was blanc-cote in both of the games in this series, and I think the Heat offense really struggles. And then the other problem, though, is that when he goes out with foul trouble, which he was also in both these games, they have big-time problems at backup center.
Yeah, it's a huge question, and they don't really have a good answer for it. And I think we should talk a little bit more about Lin, because, you know, his efficiency in this game was incredible. He had 21 points. He only attempted 10 field goals, and some of that's because he was 8 of 9 from the line. And he just makes that kind of an impact. Also, he had 3 turnovers, but I mean, from what I remember, none of them were particularly heinous. And he's just playing really well in this series, partially because Miami is making the choice to put their defensive guys that defend on the guards on other guys.
Lin and Kemba Walker, who was also awesome with 34 points on 31 shooting possessions, combined for 55 points in this one. And that is the result of what Miami's strategy has been, taking away the three-point line. They are guarding the pick and roll with two guys. Unfortunately, when Whiteside goes out of the game, one of those guys is Amari Stoudemire. And Charlotte has exacerbated that problem by starting Al Jefferson. That means that Cody Zeller, who's a much better pick and roll player than Jefferson, is now partnered with Lin. And then you also have Hawes, who, you know, kind of hangs out by the three-point line. And so that's enabled Lin to get right to the basket. Stoudemire has really struggled to contain him in pick and roll situations in both of these games, and that's why Lin has been doing so well. And then Walker was unbelievable in the fourth quarter for a time. I think he had 10 straight points for Charlotte, and I was just reminded of how incredibly quick he is, his change of direction. Sometimes he'll get down in the baseline and you're like going full speed and just like he's going to plow into the stanchion and somehow arrest his momentum and will stay in bounds and can find people on the baseline. But even he, you know, he took 8 of their 16 three-pointers. And so that shows, again, the Heat are just sticking to their shooters in the pick and roll. And, you know, Walker is getting a few of them when they go under a little bit, but because they're trying to contain him. But, you know, I think the Heat strategy is working okay. They just have to get a little bit better defensively, especially against some of those backup units. Their bigger problem is the offense.
Yeah. Another guy who had a nice game, not as prominent in the box score, was Courtney Lee, a player that they picked up at the deadline and has been a huge part of it even before Batum went out.
Yeah, Lee played 42 minutes, and he had 11 points, and he had two massive offensive rebounds late when Dwayne Wade didn't box him out. He just went to the free throw line, and he just got up, too. Like, his energy in this game running the floor was fantastic. He also really teed up Wade, who was only 4 out of 11, although he did have 10 assists. And, you know, for Miami, I mean, they really, their offense down the stretch was not very good. Wade hit a couple of crazy shots, like one fadeaway on the baseline that was unbelievable, but they weren't really able to get great shots down the stretch. Goran Dragic did not finish the game. He scored 12 points in 23 minutes, but it was in foul trouble. And then Kemba Walker was going so well that Josh Richardson actually played more minutes than him. And Josh did a great job guarding Kemba in the last few minutes as Charlotte really, you know, their offense kind of devolved and Miami was able to come back a little bit. So, to see, is it going to be Richardson getting more time now at point guard? And now that means everything's going to run through Wade. Dragic, I think, is the only guy in this Miami team that you can really trust to shoot a three-pointer off the dribble. You know, and they've been going under. He was 2 out of 4 on threes. He's been shooting the ball reasonably well. Justice Winslow, 1 of 5 on threes. He really regressed. You know, can he find his shooting stroke again, or at least get to the rim, which he did a little bit of in second half? I don't know. I mean, what do you think is going to happen in Miami? Because I feel like Charlotte, this, like, what's happened in these last two games has kind of been closer to, you know, what my prior was. And so I want to believe in that, but it's also the Heat going back where they completely dominated in the first two games.
Miami's offense was just, the shots that were going in for them were so ridiculous in the first two games that I think that the mean, as you feel, the mean is closer.
Well, let me push back on that a little bit. I think they shot very well on wide open jumpers, but they also, Whiteside was going like 9 of 9 in both of those games, right? Like, that part of it, and sure, we talked about how bad the defense was, and like, all right, you have to take something away. And now they've taken something away. And we always knew that the Heat's jump shooting was going to regress anyway. But I think that, you know, it wasn't necessarily, I thought Miami was playing great offense in those first two games, despite the fact that they were also shooting incredibly well. I mean, they had the highest offensive efficiency of any team in any game this year, I think, in game two.
Right. That's more of what I meant, is that they were hitting everything. And even if you're executing perfectly, you wouldn't expect that kind of a return. You know, that's just the way that offense works. You can say it's a make or miss league. It's not a make or make league. And I think that will be a factor, but I also think their defense will probably be a little bit tighter. And I'm interested in whether Spo will figure out some sort of alternative to Whiteside, or to Stoudemire at center. We've talked about Josh McRoberts, so I think it's interesting.
Like, yeah, give McRoberts a shot. Like, you can't be any worse than Stoudemire has been. You don't know he's going to be better, but Stoudemire has been bad enough that you have to try something else.
Yeah, exactly.
Another couple of notes on this. Frank Kaminsky came back to earth, negative 16 in his 25 minutes, 1 of 5 from the field, 2 of 4 from the line for 4 points. The Heat were able to get some decent shots running pick and pop with him guarding Luol Deng. Deng guarding him was much more difficult cover, and Kaminsky, his few post-ups and drives didn't really work all that well. The other thing that they were able to do, too, is when he put the ball on the floor, kind of the near side wing, he's so slow driving to the basket, although he is effective if he just is completely unmolested against someone. He can kind of just go back and forth and spin and, you know, work his way there. But what they did was they actually had a wing dig down as he would put the ball on the floor, and that kind of forced him to slow up or pick up his dribble on occasion. So that was, I don't know if that was a specific adjustment, but that seemed to work pretty well. So I don't know. I think I would have a quick hook on Kaminsky, especially because I think Zeller has been really good defensively, and I thought that Steve Clifford did well to close with Zeller instead of Al Jefferson. So their closing lineup, I think, is probably going to be ultimately their best lineup. Walker, Lynn, Lee at the 3, Marvin at the 4, and Zeller at the 5. Your only downside there is that maybe you're a little small with Lynn and Lee, but Lee held up okay against Dwayne Wade.
Yeah, I think that's their best lineup with this, and especially if you're not losing as much if Miami's basically not going to either play or not going to go through Goran Dragic.
Yeah, for the Heat, other than Stoudemire, I'm not really sure what else you can do. Like, I think you just got to hope that your core guys start playing better. Whiteside's got to play better. He needs to get more offensive rebounds, play harder, protect the basket better against these point guards, stay out of foul trouble. You know, and that's kind of a make or miss proposition. You know, that's the white side or blonde coat. Like, you don't know which you're going to get. And, you know, Wade is, I think he is good at times, and he probably plays a little better at home when, you know, they've got the crowd behind him. But, you know, I don't think he's a guy you can count on every single game. Dragic is the guy I think they really need to get the offense back in gear, but he's been taken advantage of defensively in pick and roll, especially when he's in at the same time as Stoudemire. You know, he had big time problems in the first half in that one. So I think you just need your guys to play better. And they just, you know, they tried Haslam, they tried going with a wing at center at times in those two games in Charlotte. I'm not sure which of those is the best way, but their rotation is looking awfully thin. Let me ask you this, though. Ethan Skolnick wrote about this today. The Heat losing this series could have some very big ramifications for their offseason.
Yeah, it could. It's Miami's appeal, I think, exists, you know, kind of outside of their success in that way, but it does affect. There's a big difference this year because they have a lot of unrestricted free agents themselves that are important, and so it could affect the way that Hassan Whiteside thinks about the Heat. It could affect the way Dwayne Wade thinks about the Heat. So,
well, and I think it could affect the way they think about their own free agents, Whiteside and Luol Deng being chief among them. I mean, Wade, you assume, will be back, but, you know, for how much as well? You know, if he's making $20 million this year, is he going to sign again for 3 years, $10 million, or is he going to want 15, or is he going to want 20? You know, and he's had as good of a year as you could have hoped. You know, you think he's going to have some pretty big demands. Is he going to go the Dirk Nowitzki, Tim Duncan route? Is he going to go closer to the Kobe Bryant route? You know, it's kind of hard to say it in that way. And they're going to have about $40 million to work with, but they're going to have to re-sign or replace Wade, Deng, and of course Whiteside, who is making the minimum this year and whom they have to use cap space to re-sign because he's an early bird guy.
My instinct is that Whiteside won't be back.
If they lose this series, I think almost certainly, like, they're not going to pay him a max to bring back this team that just lost in the first round.
Yeah, and they can't treat this as a definite that Chris Bosh is just going to be back, that, oh, you know, well, if we had Chris Bosh, we would win this series. We would have given Cleveland a series in the Eastern Conference Finals. I mean, regrettably, they can't use that as an operating assumption anymore.
Yeah, and it does seem like there is a disconnect between Bosh and the organization. The organization does not appear to want him back, and he seems to think that he could come back. You know, and there was a good article again by Ethan Skolnick as well over the weekend kind of talking about that. If you want to know more about the situation, I recommend reading that one. But Bosch's wife treated like, hey, bring Bosch back. And, you know, the organization doesn't want to do that. I think, you know, number one, just for liability reasons, for, you know, just wanting to protect their player. I mean, that's what you have to do with a lot of these guys. If you're doctors, you know, you have to look out for their health. And I think they're making the right decision. But there is also a component that if Bosch comes back and plays and then he suffers another recurrence and has to retire, then it knocks back the distance that they can get a long-term injury exclusion for him and exclude his salary. So that might be a slight component. We don't need to get into exactly what the rules for that are. Maybe over the offseason we can, as this situation starts to get a little more clarity. But it was interesting to see Bosch's wife tweeting that, and that there does still kind of seem to be a little bit of a disconnect, despite the fact that Bosch has been joining the team on the road for these last two games.
Anything else on this?
One other just quick note. The Heat were down 4 after Courtney Lee got an offensive rebound and got fouled and made both free throws when Charlotte was up 2 at the end. And so they inbounded on a sideline out of bounds, and they threw the ball into Dwayne Wade on the baseline, and he shot a fadeaway 2 that missed. You have no chance of winning when you're down 4 with 4 seconds left inbounding on a sideline out of bounds. But your only chance, we've seen it, I think, done one time, and it was actually against the Heat, so they should know that it works. You have to throw the ball in directly to the basket and just hope that you can get like a tip in that for a 2 that takes, you know, 1 second or less off the clock so you can then foul. And there's still time to come back and score again if they miss one of the free throws. You can't shoot a 3 because it's going to take too much time. And Boston did that against the Heat, I think in 2013-14, one of the early Brad Stevens games. But, you know, that's your way to have a 0.1% chance in that situation instead of a 0.0% chance.
Yep, it's an interesting idea.
All right, I think we're done here. You got anything to plug before we go?
Actually, I do. So you've known about it for a little bit, but I'm very excited to announce that I am going to be running a Warriors kind of division for a website called The Athletic. They've been running in Chicago now for a little while, and we had a conversation, and so it's going to be a new Warriors site, going to have a ton of great content, going to try to bring in stuff, of course, plenty of my own work, but try to bring in a lot from other people, and it will launch Wednesday morning.
All right, can't wait to see that. Looking forward to hopefully some cameos there. They're doing a great job in Chicago, too. They have John Greenberg, who used to be with ESPN Chicago there. So I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys come up with. For us, if you haven't listened to it yet, listen to that podcast with Kara. That should still be green. We talk about a lot of stuff that's not necessarily just germane to, you know, exactly where the series were at that point. She had some great theories just on general basketball, how to rest players. She was fantastic. I hope that she gets as many games as they can give her on ESPN. She's supposed to be broadcasting one this weekend, actually. And aside from that, just follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. And we'll talk to y'all tomorrow night, probably pretty late after the Warriors home game that we will both be going to. Till then.